Good afternoon. So last time we talked a little bit about what shells were and about starting executables. So, and moved on from talking about how fork and exec work to talk about other things that shells do, like redirection. Gave us a reason to talking about how files work in the POSIX API. And we have this notion of file descriptors that we have for every process, a table, an array of pointers to files that are open. And the file descriptor is just an index into that array. And we have this convention that our input, output, and error were just 0, 1, and 2, and that's just a decision we made in programming our library. It's not something that the operating system actually needs to know about. It's just an array. It doesn't change when it execs, keeps the same. We talked a bit about open, read, write, and close, and buffering. And we started talking about, last week, about dupe2. Notion that, well, sometimes you want to change what file descriptors point to. One example was in a shell, I can run a command, like make redirected to output.txt, so I can read my very long output later, rather than having it go to the terminal. And the way we implement that is by opening output.txt and using dupe2 to reassign it to the normal number 1 for output. And we also talked about another shell feature of pipes that I could say, take my make command and redirect it into some other command. And that would make the output of make be the input of this next command. And we'd achieve that by using this special mechanism known as a pipe, where we get a pair of file descriptors, where write into one, let us read the values from the other. And we make one of them the output of one process, one of them the input of the other. Okay, so any questions about things we covered last week? Or anything I may have forgotten to put on my hasty things I know we covered last week summary? Okay, so some homework notes. If you had trouble submitting late for homework one due to the submission system, which I suspect is not many people based on the number of submissions, let me know. Also, if you joined the class very late and didn't submit, let me know. The add deadline was yesterday, so I'm not going to be picky about that. Also, for the shell homework, there were two tiny errors in tests. So there was one flaky test, one test which was picky about something that we didn't actually want to care about. So there's an updated version of the test file. For that, there was one error in the instructions. We implied there was a test non-pipe mate target at one point. I fixed that, so now we tell you how to run that properly. But if you're looking at old instructions, that might come up. Just as brief note. Okay. And otherwise, so let's go back to pipes. So last time when we looked at pipes, we mentioned we have this general pattern that we can get an array of two file descriptors, one of which is the read end, one of which is the write end. And from one process we write, from the other we read. That's the typical pattern. You could do it from one. We have this broken example where we learned that the way pipes were implemented when we finished up last time was that typically in the kernel we have a buffer and writing goes into that buffer, reading takes things out of that buffer, and if we run out of space in that buffer, write is going to wait until there's more space. If we try to read and there's nothing in that buffer, it's going to wait until it knows that there's not going to be anything left coming. And the way it does that, as we'll talk about next, is that it looks for whether anyone can write to them. So here's a typical example of setting up using a pipe. So here I create a pipe, I check for an error, like being out of file descriptors, figure out the read or write end, and I create two processes. So I'm not going to have this problem of writing and reading you know, writing and then needing to wait for the read to happen later, because we're going to do the write and read at the same time. So we can always run the other thing until it gets far enough in writing or reading to make sure that we don't hang. So my procedure here is I fork, and in my parent, where the child child PID is zero, so we didn't find it out, so we're in the child, I write to the pipe and then exit, and in the parent, I read from the pipe, then wait for the child and then exit. So something to note, so we have our standard boilerplate for dealing with fork, where I fork, I always wait a bench somewhere. In this case, I do it immediately. In your shell assignment, you might not always do that. When I think it's done, and I have my parent-child block, and I have a bit of code to handle a fork error, like we ran out of memory. Note that I'm closing the pipe, and this close is really important. So read for a pipe will indicate end of file. The way read indicates end of file is by returning zero, but it will only indicate end of file if there is no copy of the right end of the pipe open anywhere. So if we don't close this and we try to read later on, it's going to say, well, there's still more stuff you could read, and it's going to wait for that stuff. Just because it's thinking someone could still write to this pipe. Without that, when the child process exits, there's no longer going to be a write into the pipe open in any process. So the reads are going to return end of file, that's they're going to return zero, and we'll find out that things work. And in the shell, this is really problematic if you don't do this right, because then your make pipe to grep will hang, because grep will say, well, I'm not done yet, if there is a copy of that the thing make is writing to still open after make exits. So make might be done, but grep's going to try to keep read and say, read is not returning yet, and it's not returning because the OS is saying someone could still write to that. So we're not done yet. And it will do that, even non-intuitively, if the only process which could still write to it is grep. Even though grep won't do that, the OS doesn't know that, it doesn't check for that. So I also close the other file descriptors, and this is just a good habit to avoid leaking file descriptors. The table is of finite size, you will run out eventually. And in the shell, for example, you wouldn't like your shell if after you ran 1,000 commands, you couldn't run anymore because you were out of file descriptors. That's not a very friendly shell. You know, like a web server, you wouldn't like it if you can accept 10,000 connections from web clients or web browsers, and then it stops working. It's not acceptable. So please do this, even though maybe it won't come up very often in many, cases where you're working normally. Yeah. The question is for the children, you don't have to care about that. So when a process exits, it does get rid of its file descriptors. So in that sense, you don't have to care. Now, if you're starting like grep or something, or it would be nice to not have grep have one less file descriptor than it should. So you shouldn't do that. And real shells won't do that because they aren't in the habit of having reserving file descriptors that the processes could use instead. So any other questions about this? People look confused. Yes?
So then the child process, would you need to close the write file descriptor after writing to the pipe?
The question is, would I need to close it? So I could close it here. That would be valid. In this case, I didn't because I know I'm exiting, and exiting always closes all your open file descriptors. Yeah?
in the example that we had last week where there was like the, you have the write and then the read right after it.
Yeah.
Because the write wasn't able to finish, right?
Yeah.
Because you weren't like reading from the buffer. Why does that not happen here?
So the question is, why doesn't this, so why does this hang but this not? And the reason is that these two pieces of code are run in parallel. So it's true that this write is going to be waiting for the read to happen, but fortunately, the read is going to be happening at the same time. So in the worst case, the write can hang, but the read, but then the read gets run shortly thereafter and stops the write from hanging. Yeah.
And they're running parallel because they're two different processes, is that why?
And they're running parallel because they're two different processes? Yes, that's correct. Other questions? Yeah.
What happens if like the read from pipe runs before the write pipe?
The question is, what happens if the read from pipe runs before the write to pipe? The read's gonna wait for data to be available. So, nothing bad, just the read starts, then eventually the OS gets to run the write, and the read is able to return. Yeah.
And so the reason, so you said in the if statement, you don't have to close because it's closed on the exit.
Yes.
But then you have to close in the parent, and is that because even though they're like the same file, they have two different file descriptor tables?
The question is, why do I have to close in the parent? Why doesn't that mess up the child? So yes, they have separate tables. So we can think of that, yeah, there's two arrays with pointers to the same open file, and closing just empties an entry in the array. So we're only emptying our own process's array, so closing in the parent doesn't change the child's file descriptors. And vice versa. And like exiting the child doesn't close all your file descriptors. The parent still keeps running normally. Okay, other questions? Okay. So this is sort of an example of using a pipe within one program. We talked about the example of connecting two commands together. So here's an implementation of ls minus one into grepfoo. So first I create my pipe, then I fork a process for ls. If I'm in the child for ls, I make ls's standard out go to the pipe with dupe two. I close the other copies file descriptors in my process for the pipe. So I'm not leaving any extra file descriptors open. And then I exec ls. And then I do the same thing for grep, but instead of making standard out go to the pipe, I make standard in go to the pipe, and then run grep. In real code, I'd have more error checking here. Like I check if fork fails, I check if exec fails, but I've omitted that for space on this slide. Any questions about this code? Yeah.
So why do you close the pipe file descriptors before you run the program?
So the question is, why am I closing before I run the exec? So one thing is that exec closes things, but exec doesn't. So even though the process won't know the number of the file descriptors, it will still be open. It will still prevent it from opening as many file descriptors as it might want to. And it will still affect whether reading from the pipe gives you an end of file. So it's gonna waste space, and in the case of the pipes, it's gonna make read erroneously not return end of file, because we have these extra copies, if we had these extra copies, we didn't close. And the general rule is you close everything. So you don't want to just limit all your sub-processes of your shell. So what happens here, I have this picture to make it clearer, is we call pipe, and let's say we get file descriptors 3 and 4 as our pipe. So then in our first child, we make 4 standard out. And then we close 3 and 4 and exec ls. And our second child, we make 3 standard in, then we close 3 or 4 and exec grep. And in the parent, we also close 3 and 4. So note that something I did is that I made sure I only had the copies of the file descriptor, of the pipe file descriptors I actually need open in any of the processes that are left running. And this is what you should be doing in your shell. This is the general pattern you want to do to not waste space resources. So any questions about this? Okay. So now that we've talked about pipes, here's an exercise. So I have some code here that uses pipes. It tries to write a character A from the child to the parent, and it's broken. It outputs read 0 bytes instead of read 1 byte. So what's happening? Okay, so who thinks they have an explanation for what went wrong here? One person, two people. Okay, you have, that's all you first, so.
Is it because we return 0 on end of file, and since you closed the file descriptor?
Okay, so your concern is we closed the file descriptor, so we got end of file. That is true. But doesn't get to the heart of why this is happening, of what's confusing about this code. It's a fact. But it is true, returning 0 means that it must be the case that the right end of the pipe is closed. But that's not all the rights end of the pipe are closed. There's no copy. Yeah?
Is it because we need a wait PID in the parent section?
So the question is, do we need a wait PID? We should wait for our child process, or we'll waste a space in our OS keeping track of that status, but that is not causing this problem. But it is something we should do. Okay, any other ideas? Okay, good. Guess I'll give you an extra minute. You can discuss with your neighbor so you figure out what's going on. There's an error in this code, which sometimes comes up on the shell assignment, which is one reason I'm bringing it up. Sorry.
Is it in the read call, so the number of bytes that are being read?
It's a question, so are we reading the wrong number of bytes? No, we're reading 1 byte into one character. Okay. Yes. So is it because we fork before we call our pipe call? Yes. So we create two sets of pipes, one in the parent, one in the child. So what's happening here, and this is sometimes a thing people do on the shell assignment, is we have our parent process is running, it forks a child, we create a pipe here and a pipe here, and they're completely separate pipes. And the parent's getting 0 because it closed the right end, the only right end of the pipe. The child's writing to a completely different pipe that the parent can't read from because it doesn't have a file descriptor for it. So I thought this would be less subtle to someone, but apparently not. But this comes up on the shell assignment occasionally, and it's obviously confusing.
So we need to like switch the order of the fork and the
pipe. Yeah, so the fix for this is that this fork needs to occur after the pipe call. So we have the pipe created once, not twice, not two pipes. Each time you call a pipe, it creates a new pipe. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay. And so another question about pipes. This is something which doesn't come up in the shell assignment, but I'd like you to be able to reason about. So here I have some code which sends a bunch of characters from the child to the parent. And the question is, what are the possible outputs? So you call write a bunch of times, for 0 through 9 in the child. And the parent, we call read once and output each character that we read. My question is, what outputs might we expect from this? I'll give you a minute. You can discuss with your neighbors. Give me a minute and a half. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, who thinks it's A, B, C, D? Okay, some people. E. Okay. F. Okay. Something else that we're not mentioning. I think I did all the didn't do none of these. That was an output I didn't write down. Okay, so I think the answer is D. So let's start with the most obvious possible output, which I think is A, is one of the most obvious possible outputs. One way we could get A is the child runs its entire if statement up to the exit before the parent starts. Then the parent asks to read 10 bytes. It gets 10 bytes. Those bytes are 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. All the bytes the child put in the buffer. And the buffer was big enough that it held all of them. So that's one way that could happen. Okay, so that's A. So B can happen. Let's say the child runs its first write, and then the parent runs. What the OS is going to do, typically, is that read is going to return if it has something, just like it from a keyboard. Like it will return if it has something you can ask for, like a kilobyte. If there's not a kilobyte, it will still give you something. So it can be the case that you could get B, though I agree it's probably not super likely, but it's definitely possible. C is not possible. And the reason why is that read returns zero on end of file. So it's not going to return zero if there's not an end of file. So if there's nothing available, read's going to wait for something to be available or return an error. It's not going, and in this case, it's not, shouldn't return an error. There's nothing, assuming, because we say they don't fail. Yeah?
Wait, so is the zero from the end of file, or is it the first?
The zero would be what's in buffer of zero. So would any substring of A, any substring that starts with zero would be possible. We'll still get things in order. But it just might be the case that the child hasn't finished writing everything yet. And we'll get whatever it wrote already. Yeah?
Is this code at all affected by the fact that the like second part isn't within that else if B is greater than zero?
The question is there any difference if I were to do some else here? And the answer is no. Exactly the same as if I did anything else there. I was just saving a little space on a already busy slide. Question?
Did you use await for the child process? Then was that only possible after PA? Is it was able to write everything?
So if I did a wait for the child process with the only possible output be A, the only possible output would be A, and you could argue and C because of hanging, if the pipe buffer wasn't big enough. It turns out that POSIX guarantees that the pipe buffer is at least like half a kilobyte, I think it is. So you'd only get A. But if you were writing more, the child might hang because it would try writing and there'd be no space left. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Wait, how does B, can you go over B again?
So how does B happen? So the way B happens is that we call, is that the child writes its first character. Just remember the child, we have our parent and the child are running in parallel. So the child does its write, then the parent does its read here before the child does its next write. And the read is going to read what's available. Another way it could happen is if we do our read up here, that read is going to return after the first write, potentially immediately.
The read will wait for the
write. It will wait for there to be something, because returning zero means end of file. So read returning zero always means end of file. That's just an arbitrary rule POSIX made. And by default, read just waits if there's no input available. You can request read to return immediately with an error instead, but that's not the default behavior. There's a way of doing that. I can tell you, follows FCNTL. You can look it up. But read can return less than requested. So if you ask to read 10 bytes and there aren't 10 bytes, it might still give you something. Okay. So that's everything I have on the Unix API. I'm going to move on to talking about sort of more internals, talking about running processes. So we talked about processes running in parallel, and we'll get to how that actually works. So our Unix API, we had our creating processes was done with this fork. And if we wanted to spawn a new program in our child, which was a copy of the original program, we changed what program we were running with exec. That was our usual pattern. We wanted to wait for a program. We used this wait PID in order to pause our parent process while our child is running until it finishes. Talked about files. We had this open read write close interface, which we'd use for any type of thing. And we mentioned that it's going to be the interface for like keyboards, for devices, for the network, and so on. And we'll see examples of that later in the semester. And we refer to them with these file descriptors, which are just indexes into a per process array, an array which has pointers to the open files, and that's copied on fork. We mentioned redirection in the pipeline, which we do by manipulating what's in these arrays with dupe 2 in order to make 0, 1, and 2, which are special indices for input, output, and error, map to what we want. So any questions on our Unix API that we've talked about so far before I go on to other topics? Okay, so let's talk about how XV6 runs multiple programs together. And we saw that we had this process control block. So where are those kept? And it turns out in XV6, we have this thing called ptable, the table of all processes, which has an array of fixed size for processes. So in a real OS, you probably wouldn't have a fixed sized array for this, at least for like a desktop OS. You probably make this dynamic, but it's the same concept. We have a list of all processes. We have this lock. The purpose of the lock is to keep more than one thing from accessing at once. We have this rule that we're going to do what's known as acquiring the lock before we change any process's state. We'll talk much more about locks in a few weeks, but for now we're just saying that we have this rule that we acquire this lock beforehand and release it afterwards. And most importantly, this is going to disable interrupts while we're manipulating this list of processes. So we're not going to worry that a timer interrupt is going to happen while I'm looking at my list of processes and changing things. We're just going to acquire a lock which will prevent interrupts from happening. Just so I'm not confused about what process am I running now. So we have this fixed sized array of processes. So one question is, how do we create them? So on a fork, we're going to allocate a new struct proc. And the way we do that is we look for an entry in the array which has a state of unused. And if we don't find one, we return an error from fork saying we're out of space. And if we do find one, we start allocating memory like for the stack and all that, all the stuff the process needs. So this is creating a process. And we have to create a first process. So we're going to run this code on boot. We're going to find that the first process in the process table is unused, and we need to set that up. And the first process is special because it's not created with fork. We need to set up its initial state. And I showed you before how we set up like its kernel stack. So we set it up, this kernel stack that makes it look like it's in the middle of a system call, but it's not really. But we also need to do something special to load a program in it. So we have to load the user space part. So the way XV6 decided to do this is that they have a hard-coded initial program where they just have the machine code in the kernel as an array. They call a binary init code, which just contains the assembly for execv init. So there's this special program called init, and they just run at boot something, just a little bit of code program that execs that. And that's what our first process does. And it turns out that we map that to address 0, which is why we see it setting the value of the EIP, which is the program counter, when we return from an exception to be address 0. So we just modify our user registers like we had an interrupt happen with a system call at address 0. So when we return, we go back there. We also set a stack pointer because we kind of need one. And we happen to set it to be at the top of the first page just because we don't need much space. So we only allocate one page of memory for this program. But we need an initial stack pointer for that code to work. So after we've set up this process, so it's now we set up, we have its kernel stack, we have its user space registers ready to return from an exception, we set it as runnable, and somehow we switch to that kernel thread eventually, and then return from the exception handler and go and start writing this user code. So we're going to talk mostly not about starting the initial process, but given that we have processes set up like this that are marked as runnable on this list, how do we decide when to switch to them? What are the mechanics of switching to them? especially when things get started, when we have not just the first process, but all these processes on our process table, which we need to decide which one to run, when to run it. You know, how does that happen? So that's what our next topic is going to be. So for now, we're going to talk about threads and processes. And in XV6, each process has one thread. There's one thread, and our textbook talks about thread scheduling, thread being the part that runs on the CPU. It's what we're scheduling. This is going to be synonymous with process scheduling for now because we have one thread per process. And generally, as we'll learn when we talk more about threads, modern OSs do schedule threads and not processes. So we'll talk as if we're scheduling threads just because that's what modern OSs do when we have processes with multiple threads in them. So they just schedule the threads, not the processes. Have a list of threads instead of a list of processes to run. But when you see reading about thread scheduling, there's a certain part of this process control block which is really the thread state. So if we had a multi-threaded process, each thread would probably have its own kernel stack, its own state variable, which is like unused, running, runnable, that sort of thing. We'll go through those states in much more detail in a bit. Its own set of registers from user space, its own set of kernel registers, and its own information about whether it's sleeping, waiting on something or not. So there's this information which is kind of put together with the process information in XV6, which if we had multi-threaded processes, this would be a separate struct, and each process would have multiple of them assigned to it, but would share the other things. So to make that clearer, sort of our single-threaded process, we have our files, our process ID, and so on, and our code and our data, and our stack, our registers, our RPC, the things that make up our thread. In our multi-threaded process, we still have those files, the PID, the code, and the data segment, but those are shared among multiple threads, each of which has their own stack, their own registers, and their own program counter. And these threads are the things we decide to run on the CPU or not. Okay, any questions about this model? Okay, so for now, we're gonna look at XV6, and we're gonna have an assignment which works on the scheduler in XV6, so we're only gonna be concerned about single-threaded processes. Later on, we'll talk about what multi-threaded processes look like a bit. Okay. So that's our multi-threaded process. So we have our processes starting with, in the case of XV6, init, and we fork off multiple of these, and we have a bunch of them we need to schedule, get run on the CPU at some point, and we need to keep track of all of them. We have this big table, and we distinguish which ones we can run and which ones we can't through their state. So XV6 has a bunch of states for processes that things go through. So I'm gonna go through all these states. So, and I have sort of the names that you might see more likely in our textbook and the names that XV6 uses for the state variable. So the first state is what XV6 calls embryo, or called new. So we saw that we look for an unused process. So XV6 in fact has something it does after it's unused, it marks it as an embryo, and that means it's setting things up like that trap, it's setting up like the stack pointer, and so on. So it's allocated the process, but it hasn't actually initialized all of its variables yet, has this state for that. So it's being created, but it's not ready to run yet. It hasn't started. We're like allocating memory for, we're loading the program, the initial program to run in it, whether it's init or something else. But it's not actually something we can switch to. Then we have the state called ready or runnable, which is something which could be put on the CPU. We could switch to this program and start running it, you know, from some exception right now. That's what that state means. It's not running yet, but we could run it right away. And when we do, we're going to set its state to running. And that means that it's actually on a CPU. If we had multiple cores, it's on one of them, and we don't necessarily know which one. If we have a single core, it's on the single core. It occupies the registers that are active on that core. So then we have two possible things. So one thing is that our process is doing a bunch of computation on the CPU, and it decides it's done, so it makes a system call to exit, and it becomes finished. Another possibility is it makes a system call to wait for some event, and it becomes waiting. This is like if we read from the keyboard, we go into this waiting state. So we're waiting for an external event to happen. XV6 calls this sleeping. You might associate sleeping with like the sleep call, which like waits for a certain amount of time. But this state applies to things like I'm reading from the keyboard and the user hasn't pressed the key yet. We're waiting for some sort of event to happen. That could be a timer expiring, or it could be a keyboard press or something like that. And we have this finish state, which XV6 calls zombie. This is done except for being waited for. When it's waited for, we're going to actually get rid of it, but we need to keep track of it because we need to know its exit status at the least. And there's one edge I forgot to add here, which is we can have processes go from running to ready without going to this waiting state. And the reason that can happen is if we decide to run another program and there's nothing the program did to wait, it's still runnable. It's ready to run even if we're not still running it. Okay, so these states, yeah.
So this implies that we can go from sleeping to runnable without actually running the program. So are we then gonna have to keep track of information about why sleeping?
So the question is, do we need to keep track of information about why we're sleeping? And the answer is yes. That's going to be kept track of separate from the state. In XV6, it happens to be this CHAN variable is where we're keeping track of that, which I think is so named because it's the input channel we're waiting on. So in XV6, the way we just keep track of the state for every process. We have this table, and whenever we need to find something out, we scan the entire list of processes for everything that's in the appropriate state. Another view of these states is that we can think of it as a bunch of queues. So we can have a ready queue, which is the list of processes that are ready, and we're going to take things off the ready queue and start running them. They become runnable. They run for a while, and then either they're still ready, like we have a timer interrupt, and they go back to the ready queue, or they're waiting for something, and they go on some queue for the thing they're waiting on. And I'm using this queue representation because it's more typical in an operating system to maybe track these things as list of processes rather than scanning through the master list and looking for at the state right now. So you can think of it as moving them from one queue to the other. But in XV6 doesn't actually represent these queues explicitly. Our ready queue is just every process on the process list that was just ready, just to keep things simpler to track. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about one of the most consequential decisions OSs have, which is, what do we take off the queue? This ready queue first. Is it a priority queue? Is it a stack? Is it a normal queue? What should it look like? That's a very important decision. There's lots of choices there. There's also choices about when do we let things go off the CPU because of a timer interrupt and so on. So this is known as this general idea of I have a queue of threads or things, and I need to decide which one to remove is known as scheduling. And we're going to talk about it for the ready queue. There are other scheduling problems that some of the same ideas apply to, but have their own peculiarities that we're not going to talk about very much. So one example here is that, you know, I'm talking about, I have like a desktop operating system, like we're responding to key presses, we're scheduling like web browsers. Even when we're running things on a CPU, something like batch job scheduling is very different. If I'm running like tasks on a supercomputer where everything I'm running is going to run for 3 hours, like it's a very different type of problem. And maybe it's something where we can't really context switch because we'd have to save the entire thing to disk. Like it's a very different scheduling problem. But it will share some of the same ideas. But we're going to talk about our sort of desktop scheduling problem, which doesn't quite look like that. Another example of scheduling that comes up in operating systems is I/O scheduling. So you saw here I have this thing I labeled I/O queues. And this is like if I have four programs that are all trying to read from files on disk, what file do I read first? And that, you know, is another scheduling problem. I have a queue, I need to decide what order to take things off the queue and send them to the disk to read, and that's a decision which has many of the same factors, but we're going to have very different algorithms for that. So in this lecture, in the next couple lectures, we're going to talk about CPU scheduling, and we're going to talk about a specific context that isn't like, for example, this batch job scheduling. So we're going to talk about systems where programs do a lot of I/O. And why that's important is if you think about our web browser is spending a lot of its time just waiting for input. And like that's typical of things we use on our laptops and desktops or phones, is that they spend a lot of their time waiting for input. And what we're concerned about scheduling is those little bits of work they have to do in between inputs. And this is going to dramatically affect what our scheduling algorithms look like. It's going to be very different than if we're thinking about like a supercomputer, we're going to be really concerned about, I want to get as much computation done as possible. That's not going to be our concern, as we're going to find out. And we're also going to look basically at a single CPU. So this is something which isn't realistic to our desktop laptops or even phones these days. They often have multiple cores, which is multiple CPUs for this purpose. And that changes how we do scheduling. We have to make a decision of like, do I want to run this on this core or that core? That's not a decision we'll talk about. That's a very complicated decision that like could fill a couple weeks of a course. But we don't have that sort of time given the other topics we want to cover. So even though we're talking about this one idea, many of our core ideas are going to port to the other scheduling problems I talked about, but just not perfectly. They'll have different trade-offs, different ideas. And we're going to spend most of our time talking about what we'll know as scheduling policies. And scheduling policies are the decision about what do I remove from the queue, basically. And in particular, one thing that we'll port is that our simple scheduling policies will probably be okay choices for all those other scheduling problems. But then we're going to go into less simple scheduling policies. We're going to start caring about these aspects of our particular problem of like desktop computer scheduling. So, to start with simple policies, let's look at what XV6's scheduler is. So here's XV6's scheduler. So XV6 organizes a scheduler in this way where it has a thread that is the scheduler. And what the scheduler does is it runs on each CPU. For us, we'll only be running XV6 on one core, so one CPU. And it runs this infinite loop where it every iteration, it enables interrupts, then disables them to look over the process table. That's intentional to make sure interrupts happen. And and it looks for a runnable process on the process table, and if it finds one, it switches to it. That runs, and then that switches back to the scheduler. And it switches with that, remember that SWTACH function we saw earlier, that context switch function. So this runs as a thread, we switch to the process, it switches back to the scheduler decides what to do next, and it always decides what to do by just iterating through all the processes, taking the first one, next one that's available. It's set as runnable. Okay. And note that while we're looking through the list of processes, we've acquired this lock over it, and this is to make sure that only one thing at a time looks at the list of processes. In particular, we don't want it to be the case that if an interrupt happens, something's changing a process from runnable to not runnable, we get confused and decide to run it anyways. And this is how we prevent that. And the policy about what we remove from the queue is we're iterating through all the runnable processes in the order they're stored on the table, and each time we iterate through the entire list, we run everything that we saw was runnable once. Okay, so any questions so far? Other questions? Yeah.
If there are no processes or threads to run, will it just sit there and continue to?
So the question is, what happens if nothing is runnable? So for example, all my processes are waiting for input, or like another process to exit or something like that. In that case, we'll go through this loop. We'll see that every process isn't runnable. We'll release this lock. So we'll let other things access the process table, and we'll enable interrupts explicitly, and hopefully eventually, like a key press will cause an interrupt to happen and mark something as runnable. But while that we're waiting for that, we're gonna use all the CPU time iterating through the process table to discover that there's still nothing runnable. You may complain, this seems awfully inefficient, and it is. And you would not, for example, want this running on your phone, draining the battery. Yeah.
So does the acquire and release around the like where you're actually running the processes imply that you can't have interrupts during the processes either?
So the question is, does the acquire and release imply that we're stopping interrupts from happening during the processes? So it would, unless the processes did something about that. And we'll see in a bit that the processes are going to release the process table lock when they start running and acquire it before they switch back to the scheduler. And that's going to just give you a rule to make sure we never get confused about whether a process is really runnable while we're in the scheduler. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So why do you have to run STI each time in the loop? You probably don't. I guess you, yeah, I don't think you do. Yeah, you shouldn't. I'm not sure if it matters. I don't think it should. I could imagine maybe processes do something where it ends up mattering that probably shouldn't be allowed. There's probably a bug if that happens. Okay, so something I didn't show you is what's the code to switch to a process look like? And we know it involves a call to that SWTCH function we saw earlier, the one that actually does the context switch that switches from one kernel stack to the other. And it has a few other things. So one thing we do is we have this C, which is a per CPU data structure, and we track what's the currently running thing on this CPU. This is what we use to implement myproc. You might remember from the x86 intro assignment, that's how you like looked up the currently running process. So this is how we update the information. So when from trap we look up the currently running process, we get the right one. So we update that pointer. Then we prepare to run the process. So we do two things. So one is we switch to the process's address space, and that's what the switch UVM function does. And when we talk about virtual memory, much later in the semester, we'll talk about what that function's doing. But it's switching to the process's address space, so its memory is loaded. So when we return from the kernel, we'll have its code in memory. And we mark it as running. So later on, if something else looks up, is the process running, we'll find out, yes, it is. And then finally, we actually switch to the process. So we do our context switch to the kernel thread for the process. If the process is running in user mode, should be running in user mode, that kernel thread will immediately return from whatever exception got us into the scheduler to keep running in user mode. Okay. Any questions about this so far? Yeah.
So when you switch to the process's virtual memory, why is that not just part of the SWTCH?
The question is, why is that not part of the SWTCH? So if you remember that SWTCH function, it only deals with changing from one kernel stack to the other. And it turns out that you might imagine that maybe we switch address spaces on return from exception. XV6 has just chosen not to do that. The address space switch is completely separate from the returning to user mode operation, just as a design choice. Probably the reason for this is it turns out that address space switching is not particularly fast, so you want to avoid doing it more than you have to. Yeah.
Why isn't there an I in switch?
The reason they did this is because switch is a keyword in C, and you can't define a function with the same name, so their solution was to omit the I rather than like adding something else to the function. Okay, other questions? Okay. So after we run the process, it's going to switch back to us, and then we're going to keep running the code in the scheduler. So what we're going to do first is call the switch KVM function, and this changes our address space back to the kernel address space, so we get rid of the mapping of the user stuff from memory. And this is important in case we're switching back because the process is supposed to exit, in which case we don't want it loaded anymore. That memory isn't valid. And we also do some bookkeeping to remember we aren't running any program right now, so if like a keyboard interrupt happens, we know we aren't in the middle of a program, in case that's important later on. So this is what the scheduler does, and as we keep going, if you remember, this is in a loop. So the thing that will happen after this switch is we'll go to the next iteration of this loop and look at the next process in the table and check, is that runnable now? And keep going. Okay. Any questions before we move on? So we have our scheduler code. And now I'm going to talk about, like, how do we get to the scheduler code? So we know the scheduler starts running. And you know, where does the scheduler end up switching to? Where does it end up getting switched to from? So let's start with the first place. When we're running our first program, it has to start somewhere. So where does the scheduler switch to start a program? And if you vaguely remember, I mentioned we had this function fork ret that we put on that kernel stack we constructed for a new process. We made a new process. We had a kernel stack, which was had the registers for switch and then the return address of fork ret. And the fork ret function is where new processes start. It's called fork ret because it's where we return from fork in the child. So that's where the name comes from. And so when we're starting a new process, we're going to set it as runnable. And our context switch is going to take us to the beginning of the fork ret function. And the fork ret function, the important thing it's going to do is it's going to release the process table lock. So now that we're running a new program, we can let the process table change until we go back to the scheduler again later. So we're going to release that lock so we can access the process, change the process states again, you know, from system calls or something like that. And this is a pattern we'll see every time in XV6 when we have some place the scheduler switches to. Generally, the first thing we'll do is say, okay, we have the process table locked, and maybe we disabled interrupts to make sure that it wasn't changed. We're going to undo that before we keep going. Okay, so there's some other cases where we run the scheduler. So one thing is, let's say we have a timer interrupt. If you look, remember the code from trap, we called this function called yield, which somehow ran the scheduler. So what's the function yield do that happens when we have a timer interrupt? This is what it looks like. So it acquires, so this is called by the timer interrupt handler. The first thing it does is it gets a lock on the process table and uses that to change our current process, not from running to runnable. So we get a lock in the process table, so no one else looks at our current process's state and gets confused about can I run it now or not. Change it to runnable to prepare it for the scheduler to move on to a different process. And then we switch to the scheduler. That's what this sched function does. It calls switch to go back to the scheduler thread. So we're going to end up calling sched and ending up just after the switch in the scheduler, and move on to the next process and start running that. And later on, when we iterate it over the process table the next time, we'll see that, oh, this process is not running, but runnable, so I can try running it again. And when we do that, we're eventually going to start running the code just below this sched when we switch back. And the first thing we'll do is release the process table lock, say we're, you know, things are in a good state, we're marked as running just as it should be, and now we can let that be manipulated. Okay, so questions about this procedure? Yeah. What happens if you try to acquire a lock that's already acquired? You hang. So don't. You hang until the lock is released. If it's never released, you hang forever. Yeah?
So does this mean that if we're switching to a program other than the scheduler, we're always switching from the scheduler?
The question, does this mean that if we're switching to a program other than the scheduler, we're always switching from the scheduler? Yes. This is a rule XV6 follows. This is not the only way we could write an OS, but XV6 has chosen to work this way. Linux doesn't do this, for example. Linux doesn't have a scheduler thread. Scheduler is just a function that switches to another process more directly. But this is how XV6 chose to organize things, and it makes the scheduler easier to read, at least. Because it's just one piece of code that just keeps running. Other questions? Okay, so there's another case where we run the scheduler, and that's when we have to have the process wait. And this is done with a sleep function that a lot of things call. So like when you call read and the input's not available, we'll call this sleep function. The sleep function takes, most importantly, this CHAN, which is the thing we're waiting on, which we'll check later on when we figure out, do I want to wake this process up? We'll look at that to see if we want to wake it up. And the way it works is it acquires the process table lock. Because we're changing the process state, we don't want people to be confused about whether a process is running or not. And we mark ourselves as sleeping and waiting on CHAN, and then go to the scheduler. Sometime later on, something else, like an exception handler, is going to find our process and say, oh, this shouldn't be sleeping anymore. It's now runnable. And after that happens, eventually the scheduler will find this process again on a future iteration through its loop and switch back to after that scan. Call. So, this makes sense. Questions? Okay, and the code which like finds the process, this is run with the process table lock acquired. It just looks through the process list, finds a sleeping process which matches the thing you're waiting on, and marks it as runnable. And that's all like the exception handler like for a key press will do. It will just mark a process as runnable, and later on the scheduler will find it because it's marked as runnable. Okay, so questions? Okay. Okay, so that's how XV6's scheduler works. And we're going to talk a lot about the scheduling policy, which is what runnable program should be run. And you saw XV6's answer, it's what's next in the list. I'm going through the list, what's next? It's the simplest answer to code. So it's really nice in that respect. Like, pretty much implementing anything else would be more complicated. So the question is, what is actually the best answer? Like, what choice should we be making? And this depends a lot on what our goal is. So if our goal was to have the simplest possible scheduler, XV6 wins. It has the simplest one, and that's a reasonable goal to have for an operating system. But there are other things you might care about, like performance. So I'm going to make some simplifying assumptions to talk about sort of what it might mean to make a better choices. And I'm going to make these assumptions which sort of like date back to 1970, when machines were like big and shared between lots of users. So we're going to have one program per user. That's our simplifying assumption. We're going to have one thread per program, and the programs are going to be independent. So obviously none of these are true on modern systems, ever, and probably weren't true in 1970. We're going to think about things this way, and we're going to talk about like, you know, sharing between users this way and so on as a way of thinking about the scheduling problem. That, you know, when I'm thinking what program to run, I'm thinking what user do I want to run first, that sort of thing. Just to help think about this problem, but it, clearly if you want to drop these assumptions, things get more complicated, like which of my programs do I care about the most is a different question. Okay. And in this model, we can think about how programs run in a certain way. That programs, they're ready at some point, we put them on our CPU, and then something happens. Either they're still ready and they go back on the ready queue, or more commonly, especially when we're thinking about something like our desktop, like with web browsers, like they do a little bit of work on the CPU, and after that, they're waiting for something. They're waiting for some timer, or they're waiting for some I/O. Like they're waiting for something to come into the network, they're waiting for me to press the mouse. You're waiting for something to happen. And we can think of programs in a sense as having CPU and I/O bursts. That a program has some computation, then it waits for I/O, then it has a little bit of computation, then it waits for I/O. You know, and it alternates between these two. And this is going to be our model of what programs are to talk about the scheduling problem. And you can see it's motivated by this desktop example. And this is where we're going to start breaking down when we talk about things that aren't like desktop scheduling, where this doesn't work. But this is our model for now. And if you think of our shell, like our shell, we waits for a key press. And we want it to, as quickly as possible, do what it needs to do based on that key press. Like if I press enter, we want as quickly as possible to run the command, and then it's going to wait for more key presses. So those are our CPU bursts. You know, if you think of a drawing program, it's waiting for me to drag with the mouse. It's going to do a little work there, so on. Web browser, waiting for the network, and so on. And we can observe this empirically. So one thing people are very interested in for scheduling is how long are these green segments of time here, these CPU bursts? Are they very long or very short? And it depends on what program you're running. If you think of your compiler compiling, you know, your 1 megabyte automatically generated C++ file, That's going to be a very, very long CPU burst while it's doing that, probably. You think of your web browser, hopefully it's all mostly very short CPU bursts. And people have measured this empirically. So one way you can try to measure it is you can say, here's for a 1966 system. They got a keyboard log with timing, and they timed the time from when a command was entered until the next command prompt was there. The amount of computation which happened. So this meant that they made an adjustment that sometimes we have a CPU burst and like the process doesn't run for the whole time because something else gets run. We subtracted out that extra time. So we're just counting the amount of time the process needed to run to get the next prompt displayed. So they measured this. These are in buckets of ticks, which are in the system 16.7 milliseconds. So we see that the median is between 16 and 32 milliseconds. And we have this long tail where the mean is of over of several seconds. And we can look at a more recent example. Maybe you don't consider 1990 that much more recent, but you know, something more like a typical, what we would think of as a desktop. So here's a different bucketing measurement of length of CPU bursts, and this is a log scale. So we see that we have a vast majority of them are like in the couple milliseconds range, which is surprisingly not that far off from 1966. And we have this long tail of things which go out to several seconds. And this is typical. So we have these short CPU bursts, these, you know, of typically on a modern system, milliseconds, alternating with these waits for AO. And our scheduling task is that we have a bunch of these programs waiting to run their little millisecond of CPU. And the question is, when should we run each program's millisecond of CPU? Or in some unlucky cases, they're like 8 seconds of CPU. And that we have some programs, you know, waiting in different ways. We're going to make a decision between programs largely based on where we think they fall in this graph. And we'll talk about that over the next day or two. And that's where I'm done for today. I don't think I want to start this topic.